Welcome to today's episode of the Routing Table Podcast. My name is Rick, and I'm here with my co-host Melchior. Hey, Melchior.
Hey, Rick.
Today's guest is Dino Farinacci. Welcome, Dino.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Dino is currently active at his company, Lispers.net. Pretty much continuing his work on Lisp that he started while working as a Cisco fellow at Cisco. And according to his LinkedIn profile, claiming to have designed and implemented more protocols than anyone on Earth.
Wow.
Dino holds over 40 patents and 26 IETF RFCs. So that claim could actually be true. So we're actually very interested in hearing about that. So Dino, could you maybe quickly give a short introduction of yourself in your own words and explain the listeners a bit about what you're working on?
Sure. Thanks again for having me, guys. Yeah, that claim on my LinkedIn profile goes back to probably the early 80s where I worked on IBM and CDC mainframes. And at that time, in the early 80s, we had something called a device interface that connected to a cyber channel on a CDC computer. That was basically a 68,000-based router. And at that point, that's when I started working on TCP/IP. What we did is we ran the three applications, Telnet, FTP, and mail on a mainframe, and the routing, the transport and routing were done on the device interface, the separate interface over a 24 megabit channel. So at that time, I was the first one to probably do a TCP implementation that wasn't on Linux or Unix at that time. And then, you know, my history from then goes on where I went to I worked on NetBuilder at 3Com in the late 80s and then went to Cisco in the early 90s. I tell people that I worked for Cisco for 22 minus 5 years because from 99 to 2004, I went to Procket and then Procket kind of acquired Cisco kind of acquired Procket. So I came back in 2004 and then worked on data center products till end of 2012. And when I got involved with Lisp, probably in the 2006 timeframe, there was an IEB workshop in Amsterdam, the fall of 2006. And that's when I started working on Lisp. And we got it implemented on quite a bit of products, platforms at Cisco, as well as the three operating systems. And then I thought it was time for me to go out and try to make it more broadly deployable and adoptable by other vendors, talk to VCs about investing in companies that should do overlays. And it turns out that it took a while for it to catch on, but they finally got what overlays were, and now it's called SD-WAN. And so there was tons of funding of north of 50 companies doing overlays with proprietary control planes, but they are doing overlays. So back to the introduction. So yeah, I do routing. I'm a software engineer by training, and I probably worked on, I would say probably nearly 30 Cisco releases, iOS releases before I went to Procket. And then when we came back from Procket, we built the NXOS operating system that ran on the Nexus data center platforms. And a lot of the code we wrote at Procket, it was a right from scratch operating system and set of protocols at Procket. We brought that into NXOS. And we at first, we were in the 2004 timeframe, we wanted to build a SAN switch, you know, a fiber channel switch, a layer 2 bridge, and a layer 3 router. It turns out the switching, we built fiber channel line cards and stuff, but it turns out that the MDS platform really did a good job with that. And we ended up just being an L2 switch for top of rack and an L3 end of row router and data centers. And so we ran that was probably the first modular operating system. It was happening at around the same time iOS XR was coming out on the CRS platform. When Procket was building a 480 gig half rack core router, that was when the Gibson box, the T640, and the CRS were also being developed at the same time. So those three platforms were competing for the same space in the network at the core. And so when Cisco bought Procket, it turns out that they threw away all the hardware. They threw away all the salespeople. They brought some marketing and mostly engineers. And the engineers were split up between doing hardware NXOS and iOS XR. So a lot of the technology that's in the later Cisco products came from Procket. I left Cisco because I wanted to make Lisp more ubiquitous, and that's why I started my consulting company called Lispers.net. And that was to make Lisp more ubiquitous, bring it closer to applications, put it more in a virtualized manner, because VMs, you know, cloud computing was becoming popular at the time. Containers yet weren't sexy and didn't come out. Docker wasn't developed back at that time. But now that we have all these ways of virtualizing stuff and things are moving around, not, you know, we used to say that a host or a laptop could move around or a cell phone could move around, but now we're seeing microservices and functions in the network come up and go down and move around, and they want to be identified either by a DNS name or a static IP address. And with Lisp, those are basically endpoint IDs that are relatively static. So those things could stay associated with a service or an operating system and then hop around. And the binding to the routing locator is what allows you to actually get packets to that EID. But, you know, so that's kind of what I've been doing. That covers kind of the first two questions you had. I have an open source implementation of Lisp that I've been testing all the new features that we've been developing in the IETF as well as new use cases come up. And they're available for people to learn, use, whatever. It's obviously open source and free. And it's just there so people could understand overlays and the great value that they really bring to networking. You could really experiment with new things and put things at the edge and not have to talk about anybody in between and slowly transition the core to do whatever you want over a longer period of time. So I'd like to say that, you know, the Lispers.net overlay runs over a Cisco or Juniper underlay. And as long as the underlay performs and moves packets from our looks to our looks, the overlay has a really good job of doing a lot of features. And what's nice is an endpoint could have more than one rlook. So the edge or the overlay node could actually decide which rlook to use and choose different paths across the network without having to change a single fib route in the underlay. And so that's pretty powerful that you could do that switching, you know, at the endpoint. For instance, you know, a cell phone could run Lisp and use LTE and Wi-Fi and decide which interface it wants to use and talk to another cell phone that's on Wi-Fi and LTE and decide, you know, should I send packets out my Y interface to Rick's LTE interface on his phone? And if I notice an RTT change, should I then switch over to a Wi-Fi interface or something else? You know, so the multi-homing and mobility aspects of Lisp is what the level of indirection actually gave us. I'll pause for a minute so you guys could interject or ask more questions.
There was
long introduction.
Yeah, I was about to ask, is this the short introduction or the long one? Which one? No, but what really triggers me now is one of the last sentences you were in one of the last sentences you were saying, what SD-WAN is trying to solve, what is already there, or what Lisp could already offer.
I'll describe SD-WAN with an example dating back to the early 90s. There were Cisco routers and there were Protean routers. They each could switch IP packets. So if a Cisco router produced an IP packet on an Ethernet and sent it to a Protean router, it would be able to deliver it. The only problem was Protean supported only one routing protocol called OSPF, and Cisco only supported one protocol at the time. It was called IGRP. Well, since the control planes were different, we had interoperability problems. This is the state of the art or the state of affairs in SD-WAN right now. In SD-WAN, people say we're going to use IPsec to have secure tunnels at the data plane, but now we're going to use an SDN controller or some kind of application level database to do the mapping between the addresses that aren't in the underlay to the addresses that are in the underlay. And I call that EID to rlook mapping because the EIDs are the addresses that are assigned to end hosts and things that you make transport connections to. And the rlooks are bounded to those EIDs and can change. So the EID stays static and usually maps directly from a DNS name, which means a DNS name never has to change if a host is moving around because it always maps to a relatively static EID. And then the EID to binding to RLOX is what's dynamic. So in SD-WAN, it's the same concept. They're all implementing overlays, but they're all proprietary. Each vendor supports an infrastructure, and they can't talk to each other. You know, the Viptelas and the Versas can't talk to each other. So, you know, we go back to that the early 90s when we had these non-interoperable protocols like AppleTalk and Novell and IP, and then later IPv6 came in. You know, IP and IPv6 turned out to be underlay protocols so we could actually tunnel Apple devices over an AppleTalk over IP was a way to configure a static GRE-like tunnel to run those protocols over an IP network. But back then, those tunnels were part of the topology. They were virtual point-to-point or multi-point links, and you would run the actual overlay protocols over it. Like you'd run the AppleTalk routing protocols over on top of that. These SD-WAN tunnels today are relatively dynamic. They're not, quote, set up like an LSP is in an MPLS network. It's these tunnels, I call Lisp these Lisp tunnels are called dynamic encapsulating tunnels. And it's no different than when you want to put a packet on an Ethernet and you have to decide what MAC header you have to put it on so the device that's on this multi-access network should receive and then forward the packet. This is the same thing that happens with overlays, is that you decide to put an IP header on this IP header, and the outer header is dynamic and changes based on many factors.
Got it. And I think SD-WAN definitely made overlay networking a bit more go-to, which maybe some overlay stuff in the data center was before that. But it's interesting to see, because you have a very long history in working on tunneling protocols or overlay or encapsulating protocols, whatever the right naming convention is at this time. Because one of the first RFCs that we could find about you in the IETF was about GRE.
1700 something, what was it? Dina, yeah. Do you remember the number?
Yep.
1700.
No, not really, because they keep changing them sometimes as there was updates. But you know what we wanted to do with GRE, to be perfectly honest? We wanted it to be like IBM source bridge source routing, SRT. We wanted it to be able to hop across different autonomous systems. And there was an AS path in there. And we wanted to have the tunnels hop to ASs. And that's exactly what segment routing is doing right now, in a sense, right? Segment routing is doing it pretty much hop by hop within an ISP. But of course, you can go across ISPs and use loose route. And so it's not every hop. But that's what kind of the idea is. We wanted to be able to steer traffic because we were sensitive about the routing table churn and changing routes quickly at every hop to be able to move traffic. Remember, this was before traffic engineering and RSVP and stuff. So we wanted to use simple data plane mechanisms to do this, right? And of course, people would say, well, how do you choose the AS path that you select? Well, you say, well, you look at BGP and you have this adjacency rib in and adjacency rib out that you can look at these AS paths and you can select one versus the other, right? And the head end would select it, and everybody that was downstream from that had to obey the rule in the GRE header. So it turns out that those option bits were turned off, and so we didn't really use the AS path prepending that much or the AS path hopping that much. So it turned out just to be an IP and IP tunneling protocol, as you guys know.
Yeah. Well, and following some work, if I read through the RFCs, I see you've done some PIM sparse work. So there's some tunneling in there, of course, getting traffic to the rendezvous point. Of course, then Lisp. So is it more of a coincidence that you always end up working on a tunneling protocol or tunneling traffic? Or is there a more logical way?
Actually, when you just look at the work I've done in routing and not operating systems, it's just it's a level of indirection. And we solve a level of indirection in all kinds of programming techniques and data structures and algorithms. And so when you look at routing algorithms, level of indirections help you to a certain extent, as long as you don't have too many levels of indirection. So the reason I wouldn't call in PIM sparse mode, those register messages that went from the designated router to the rendezvous point, they were there because you had to figure a way to get packets to the root of a share tree. Because back in those days, the problem with PIM is we had to we had a war between shared trees and source trees. And there were academics at Belcore and other places that really thought shared trees would be the way to go. And the problem is the only way we understood how multicast trees could work was from the spanning tree protocol layer two. And having a root bridge and sending packets, you know, to the root bridge, that was easy because you would forward them natively hop by hop. We could have, so we could do that too. We could have taken packets that users, multicast packets that users originated, and we could have rewritten the destination IP address from a multicast to a unicast that basically delivered the packet unicast to the rendezvous point. And then the rendezvous point with some other mechanism would have to rewrite the multicast address and then do multicast forwarding down the share tree. So the fact that, you know, we could have done it without adding another header, but adding another header meant we didn't touch the user's packet. And, you know, the rules of IP, it's not documented very well, but when somebody originates a packet with an IP header, nobody should change the contents of that header except for the TTL, because that's what routers are supposed to do. And since they change the TTL, they're also supposed to change the checksum to reflect the TTL change. Now, we don't have this problem in IPv6 because we don't have a checksum in the IPv6 header. So it was much faster to switch an IPv6 packet because it was just a TTL decrement and boom, send it out. You know, so these were the sorts of things that were pristine about the architecture. And of course, NAT devices broke all that. And, you know, redirecting and doing function-based routing broke all that. So by putting another header on it was a simpler way of doing it. And I always tell people the other header, even though people believe there's MTU issues, which they're really not in the real world, they're not MTU issues. We can solve that many ways. But having two headers on a packet basically says, Dino, the EID, which is the source address in the inner header, is sending a packet to Rick, which is the destination IP address in the inner header. That's another EID. Is sending it from, now we're talking about the outer header, from the source address, San Jose, California, because that's where Dino, the EID, is, to, let's see, where are you, Rick? In Amsterdam, or yeah. Somewhere near? Yeah, Amsterdam. To some router that's in Amsterdam. So you're able to get the from who and to who and from where and to where all in one packet. And that's really useful when you need to debug stuff. Now, when the inner headers are not encrypted, you have that EID stuff. But now what we're doing is we're encrypting everything, the inner header and the payload, so we can obfuscate the EIDs. So in these packets that are going from Dino to Rick, all we can see is that some packet is going from San Jose to Amsterdam, and that's it, you know, because of the encryption that we do. And encryption is good. We have to turn it on for everything, right?
Agree.
For sure. Does Lisp actually support encryption out of the box or anywhere? Because I remember encapsulating traffic, right?
RFC, let's see, I got to get this right, 8061. It's called Lisp Crypto. So when you encapsulate from one RLOC to the other, and the RLOCs are sending RLOC probes to test paths between each other, a Diffie-Hellman key exchange is done there. So in my implementation, if you just say data plane security equals yes, the Diffie-Hellman happens automatically, and that you encapsulate, you encrypt, and then I should say you encrypt. You take the packet comes into the ITR, and it's just a packet with the EID header on it. You encrypt the packet, and then you set a key ID in there of which key you're using, and you encrypt the packet, and then you encapsulate it and send it to the ETR. The ETR sees the key ID, knows that the keys have been negotiated, and uses that particular key ID to decrypt the packet after it decapsulates it. And so that's a very simple way of doing Lisp crypto. But there's no PKI that's being done. It uses elliptic curve as well as other ciphers like Cha-Cha-20 and the GSM and CBC AES. So it just works out of the box. It's very simple. And a lot of people are using it. We're using it today for blockchain because the blockchain, when you're sending transactions on a blockchain and blocks, the transport are today the default code in most of the blockchains is just using TCP, but it's not using TLS. So if you run blockchain over an overlay, Lisp Crypto can give you the privacy and confidentiality of the transactions if you want it. And of course, you can rekey whenever you want, so the hosts don't have to care about what's going on. And if you're doing Lisp in your router on your edge routers going into your ISPs, then everybody, all the EIDs at a site that are being encapsulated by that edge router will get benefit of Lisp crypto, and the keys can change dynamically. You can rekey. There's up to 3 keys you can use per RLOC, so you can rekey whenever you want. And anything above the IP IP layer doesn't have to know about it. Even the IP layer in the source host doesn't have to know about it either.
Very cool. Now,
interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Actually, we'll come back to the blockchain project later. But let's
First
focus on what I found was interesting was when I read the original Lisp RFC, because I think we're focusing a lot on ISP because that's one of your more known projects. I think where you are responsible for. And I really liked that the idea came from. An event held in Amsterdam. Of course, both Melchior and I are based there, which is very interesting. But I figured the idea came to solve high FIP table sizes, right? So that internet addressing was getting out of hand and that we would not be able to grow it. I would say that didn't really worked, right? Or didn't really materialize, as we still have routers that have huge memory banks to keep the entire internet table in there. Was that still the original use case, or would you say that has changed a bit more because now it's, as you mentioned before, more about location and ID separation, other than just solving a high FIP table size?
Well, I mean, every overlay that we're running now with Lisp on the underlay, those routes are not being put in the underlay. So we are saving the table space. Even though the routers are large, they're not growing at the pace as they would have if we didn't have overlays. So every time you set up a Lisp overlay, those IPv6 routes that you use, I use the prefix FD:\8. And the reason I use that is because the other 120 bits is a hash of a public key. So I'm using these crypto EIDs in the overlay so I can sign things and have the ability to look up public keys to do verifications on signatures. By doing that and having these flat addresses and injecting them into an IPv4 underlay is a non-starter. You can't inject IPv6 routes into an IPv4 underlay. If you have an IPv6 underlay, these FD routes are special type link local routes or special use addresses, so you can't inject them in. And if you did, there'd be a /128 for every host on the internet. So, a lot of my deployments and use cases, I have the EIDs automatically assigned for IPv4 out of the 240/4 space, the class E space. And it's really very user-friendly because whenever I'm looking at tables and looking at packets, whenever I see a 240 address, I know it's an EID. And when I don't see a 240 address, I know it's an underlay address that's routable by the underlay. So the fact that we are using lots of EIDs all over the place, millions of them, in fact, and they're not in the underlay, and therefore we are solving the FIB table size problem. We didn't solve it the way the problem was described back in Amsterdam in 2006 because we were looking at how multi-homing was increasing the routing table size and how sites were connected to multiple service providers, and you had to inject more specifics into one with an address of the other service provider so you can do preferred routing. But when you had Lisp, you could just pick a Verizon or an AT&T RLOC if you were connected to each one of those service providers from the other edge, and then the provider assigned addresses could be RLOCs, but the sites could have provider independent addresses. And provider independent addresses are very nice things because if you wanted to switch from Verizon to AT&T or to another third party, all you'd have to do is give up your one RLOC that they would assign to you, and your EIDs would still be assigned out of your own space. And we know that the IPv6 policy out of RIPE is to provide provider independent addresses for IPv6. So we're kind of there already, where IPv6 if you have underlay IPv6 addresses, which are routable RLOCs, and you have provider independent IPv6 prefixes, which are EIDs. So, you know, the world is working the way we envisioned it. It was just hard to change IPv4 because of the habits that were used with IPv4, right? IPv4 was this swamp, and addresses came at different times, and people weren't giving addresses back, and people just wanted more. It was like, like the real estate. Once you get it, you want to squat and keep it. And I mean, look how much money Amazon is paying.
Oh, yeah.
I know Amazon just bought a bunch of space from Comcast and NBC Universal because they needed more V4 routable addresses. And so NBC and Comcast were able to, NBC Universal was able to name their price.
Yeah.
So very interesting, you know, scarce commodity.
I wouldn't be surprised if at one point you'll get a discount if you bring your own IP space to one of the cloud providers. We're almost at that point already, right? I mean, Amazon offers the option already to bring your own IP space, but I think we're very close to the point where they will actually give you a discount or even start paying you for it.
I only need one address from Amazon. If I start a VM on AWS, they give me a global address. That's my RLOC, and all the addresses I bring are those 240 and FD addresses that I use on my overlay. And Amazon doesn't know anything about it, and doesn't have to know about it. And they can't even look at my inside packets because I'm doing Lisp crypto, so they don't even know what type of addresses I'm using for EIDs.
Yeah. So, would you say that? What you just said is exactly one of the specifics for the use case of Lisp, because as you were just discussing with Rick, there's obviously different overlay protocols, different tunneling protocols as well. And during the preparation for this recording, you also mentioned that you're working on a project with CBS, specifically where you would use Lisp in the underlay for telemetry. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So we've been, for the Olympics, I help NBC Sports with the last few Olympics, and we've been trying Lisp in different sort of use cases. Of course, we were, they had an IPv4 underlay, but we wanted to run some IPv6 multicast. So we ran some IPv6 multicast over an IPv4 underlay. That was one of the things we did in PyeongChang. But what we want to do for Tokyo is we want to do some underlay telemetry. And so what we want to do on the venue switches is run Lisp, but we're only going to run the control plane protocol. And so by using RLOC probing, you can actually test the RTTs from, say, a venue router, at one of the stadiums to the IBC, the International Broadcasting Center, in the data center. And you could actually test the RTT of the path, and you could actually test the forward and reverse hop count direction, so you know the diameter. So if the hop count from the venue switch to the data center is 5 and the return is 3, you know you're taking an asymmetric route and the return path is shorter. And so that's interesting because, first of all, did you intend for the metrics to be different in each direction in your IGP in the underlay is number one. What we also wanted to do was to test one-way latency because they'd use multicast. So control plane protocols go from the venues up towards the EBC of the IBC, and then what happens is multicast packets go downstream natively because they have a multicast underlay. Well, we want to know what's the one-way latency from venue to data center and then data center downstream. And what we've also done is that the data center can send RLOC probes on a multicast RLOC, right? So you can encapsulate unicast and multicast in multicast, which means you could deliver a unicast packet to multiple places. I'll explain that later because we can do near zero packet loss mobility without any signaling. It's the fastest that's ever been invented without any signaling protocols by using this technique of multicasting unicast packets, okay? But I'll hold that thought to get back to NBC. So what we want to do in NBC in a data center is we want an RLOC probe on a multicast RLOC. And so what happens is we send a Lisp RLOC probe message, a UDP message, that has a destination address that's multicast. So the underlay delivers it on all the receivers on all the branches of the tree. And when they hit ETRs at the end of the tree, the ETRs then could then unicast back the RLOOK probe replies. And so what the head end is getting is not only the one-way latency down each of the branches, but also the one-way latency from that venue switch on the reply coming back. And so we're getting a lot of really good telemetry, not just hop count in both directions for unicast and multicast, and RTTs for multicast and unicast, but one-way latency as well. And so we're able to find hotspots or unexpected configuration changes, these sorts of things. And then, you know, we're graphically building trees and everything based on latency and stuff. So it's easy at the head end if you're using different multicast RLOOKs or you want to actually take a multicast packet and unicast encapsulate it to one point because you have to hop over a non-multicast island. You could certainly do that. And we're doing some work with this with in the MBONE-D working group where the guys at Akamai and some of your guys at Juniper are working on a project, multicast to your grandma, which is a project.
We've spoken with Len about that. So that was really interesting to hear from him what's going on there.
Yeah, I'm working with those guys. Lenny's great. And Jake Holland from Akamai is working on it. And we're using AMT, we're using native multicast, and we're using LISP for all these experiments. Maybe that would be a good subject to get all three of us on another interview to talk about that if you guys are interested. But that would be really fun. So we're doing some pretty advanced stuff there, really state-of-the-art multicast stuff like signing messages and doing cool things there.
So can you share a little bit on, as part of what you're doing now is evangelizing LISP, if I may call it like that. It's what are the statuses, if you can share, with any of the vendors implementing? We saw a lot of your work on GitHub as well, an open source implementation. Does the open source implementation help to drive adoption? And what is happening in that space?
Sure. So I'll first say from a standardization point of view, we're taking RFC 6830 and 6833, the data plane and control plane, and it's going to be fully standardized, standards track IETF. And we're actually in last call for what we call 6830 BIS and 6833 BIS. It's great that we're going to standardize it. And what's key there is that we're not just solving the internet scaling problem. In fact, we kind of backed away by it saying we can solve so many other use case problems. We will also, you know, not require anything of the underlay, so we could scale the system. But there's mobility use cases and VPN use cases and other sorts of things that we've been doing that we're trying to bring forward. And those are kind of the modern day use cases for LISP. And the ones I'm focusing on is IoT, the 5G network, and blockchain. And what I'm also doing is I'm working on some applications that need to be solving because of the problems we have in this world. And two of them are building a voting app that runs on the overlay and contact tracing that uses LISP as well. So the voting app is interesting because the voting app runs as a blockchain application and blockchain runs on the overlay. And the contact tracing system basically needs a scalable distributed database. So it's using the LISP mapping system, only the control plane, not an overlay, to be able to store mappings between contacts and their GPS coordinates and health state that gets merged by two different points. So the idea with contact tracing is that a phone would register its GPS coordinates with a hash of its phone number. That would be the hash of the phone number is the EID, and that's the key and the key value pair that's being stored in the distributed database. And then the value is a JSON string that contains the phone number and the GPS coordinates. So what happens is we are just simply running a very lightweight LISP control plane on the phone. And we're just sending map register messages once a minute with GPS coordinates that change as the phone moves around. And that gets registered in the mapping system. Now, that map register message is encrypted. And so in transit, everything is encrypted. And when those JSON values are stored in the mapping system, they are encrypted as well. So you don't see phone number, you don't see GPS coordinates. The data is completely anonymized, so you don't know. It's not associated with a person, an age, an ethnicity, a predisposed condition, nothing like that. And then when you go get tested for COVID, a public health agency will then enter the information of your health state. We have like one of nine health states tested positive for COVID, negative, you were exposed, you were tested for the antibody, those sorts of things. Those guys enter in the mapping system, which registers the exact same EID, but instead of GPS coordinates, it registers the health state. And both the phone and the public health authority sends these map registers with merge semantics into the mapping system. And the mapping system then merges both of those records into one entry. So there's two RLOCs, one EID, which is a SHA-256 hash, and two RLOCs, one with GPS coordinates and one with health state. So now you have this information in the mapping system. And then there's a cloud application that a government or IT infrastructure runs that reads the mapping system periodically and is able to warn people. So the idea is that if I'm in my 10-meter perimeter, if there's people that have not been tested or have tested positive, I get a text message to my phone warning me that they're in my perimeter. And as I move, I get other text messages saying, you know, if I'm moving into a safety zone or another zone. And then we also put landmarks into this mapping system. So if you guys want to go to AMS right now and you want to know what the 100-meter perimeter at AMS is, the Amsterdam Airport, then what happens is you get a list of number of positive, exposed, and you could even look at the number of entries and know at the center of AMS what the density of people are. You can build these concentric rings of density and exposure zones, and you could learn if it's safe to go to AMS. And you could say, oh, it's safe to go to the gates, but it's not safe to go to the restaurants, or it's not good to go to the ticket area, things like that. So this is simply just running a set of applications to do contact tracing, but it's using the list mapping system that is a sharded distributed mapping database that can scale.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting?
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. And is the voting app that you talked about before, is that based on the same principle?
So the voting app basically was designed, there's an admin app and a voters app. So when you actually register to become a voter, it creates a username password on the blockchain, okay? And it's a username password and PIN. And that creates a signature chain that looks like a blockchain that's relative to that user only. So nobody else, and then what happens is what we do is we allocate a single token. It's like a cryptocurrency, but we just call it a token. And the token is allocated out of a token reserve for that username, exactly one. And what happens is when you vote, you've transferred that token to one of the candidates that had been put into the mapping, into the blockchain, okay? So what happens is the candidates are usernames also on the blockchain, and the voters are also usernames on the blockchain. When a candidate becomes electable or votable, it's put in by the voting administration. And then voters, as they register to vote, their username passwords get put into the blockchain. And so by moving a token from a voter to a candidate, that shows that you have voted for that candidate and that you cannot vote anymore because you have no tokens left in your token account. Okay. Runs over a blockchain. And the thing is that these voting apps could run and they could move around. And since the voter is running maybe on a cell phone or as a VM or a container in the cloud, we can deploy this with a web interface anywhere, is that the voters and the candidates are being signed EIDs. And these EIDs could also move around. And so we bind them dynamically on our looks and then use the overlay. And of course, the votes are all, the voting is all confidential because we run it over Lisp crypto. So this is a voting application over blockchain, over Lisp crypto overlay.
Very cool. I think this really solves a lot of the security concerns when it comes to voting, especially because you can just show, hey, these are the transactions that flowed into these buckets or wallets, whatever you want to call them.
That's right, because the block. You're right, because the blockchain is immutable, so it shows when, you know, when did Dino vote for Bernie Sanders, and that Dino couldn't withdraw the vote, and that's it. It doesn't say when Dino voted. It's the hash of Dino's signature chain. Somebody voted for Bernie Sanders, so there's confidentiality even in the blockchain, right? So, but if I tell you that my username is Dino F or whatever, you could actually hash that and then look up that hash in the and then find the transaction and say, ah, Dino voted for Bernie. So, you know, hashes are one way direction. So you have to kind of keep your username and password kind of private. Now, what's cool with these voting applications, the applications themselves store no state whatsoever. There's no databases, so there's complete persistency. It's all in memory. So the usernames, the voters, the candidates, and the tokens are all state that's kept on the blockchain. That's what was cool about it. So therefore, they can move around, and the applications could come up and down, and Lisp allows them to be connected. And so there's this great persistency that's created as this system is dynamic.
This is very cool. Now, I want to go back a little bit, talk about the implementation of Lisp on systems and software. What's your goal for as far as Lisp implementation? Do you see it? Does it have to be on a lot of the networking nodes that are part of the network, or do you see it more you being useful on end hosts, like you've mentioned, phones and servers and any system?
Encapsulated. It's a very good
point.
But. Yeah, very good question. So what we do is we, in the Lisp working group, we have two forms of mobility, one called EID mobility and one called Lisp mobile node. And the difference is EID mobility means that the EID is assigned to a system that's moving around and the RLOC is assigned to a system that it lands on, like a router. So the RLOC and EID aren't co-located in the same system. In Lisp mobile node, where you would run Lisp on a mobile phone, the EID is assigned to like a loopback interface, and the RLOCs are being assigned to the radio interfaces on that phone. So the RLOCs and EIDs are co-located there. So what happens is when the EID is moving, it's because the RLOCs are changing at the same time. So both the RLOCs are changing because the EID is moving, but it's since it's doing Lisp itself and gets new RLOCs, it can register by itself. When an EID in a data center, for instance, it's moving, the EID is being assigned to a virtual machine, and we might be using vMotion, VMware's vMotion, and it's moving from one part of the data center to the other. And so when it attaches to a top of rack router or switch or end of row router, those are the RLOCs running Lisp. So that begs your question, is that Lisp in this case in the data center is running in the router, and the EIDs are actually unchanged systems that just have IP addresses. We just call them EIDs, but we know that those EIDs aren't injected into the underlay. They are not, right? They're put into the mapping system. That's the definition. The true definition of a EID is an address that is not routable on the underlay. And you find out in a Lisp router if a destination address in a packet is an EID or not, because you look it up in the mapping system. And if you get RLOCs back, that means it is an EID and that you could reach it by encapsulating to those RLOCs. If you don't find it in the mapping system, you make the assumption it's routable, and then you don't encapsulate and you send it into the internet, and it actually goes, it gets routable. So that's the way we make Lisp interworking work, how a Lisp site can talk to a non-Lisp site, right? We can get packets to be encapsulated back to a Lisp site, but packets from Lisp to non-Lisp just go direct natively on the underlay, okay? So to get deeper dive into your question, what's the best way to do this? Well, again, it's about design trade-offs. What we liked being router vendors is that we could put in an overlay and not touch any applications, any end systems. The IP addressing could literally be the same. And we could just put Lisp in Juniper and Cisco routers, Arista boxes or whatever, and they would just work because the level of indirection was being done below the transport layer. And every EID that was at a site could actually be registered in a mapping system as a prefix, not 1,000 EIDs, but a prefix in a slash, 16 or something like that. if all those EIDs came out of the same power of two block, like they might have been with a provider independent address, or if you did aggregation well in your IGP, then you can say this entire site, a multinational site, would have different prefixes coming out of it. Then now you can register these prefixes with one or more RLOAPs. And so now you just have one mapping entry that served thousands or tens of thousands of hosts. You know, I use this example all the time because it really, it makes people understand. It's like if I have tennis shoes, a pair of tennis shoes that has a sensor on it, I have a belt and I have a watch, and those are three EIDs that I can send packets to from anywhere in the internet. But the problem is they're three EIDs and they're attached to my cell phone. And in this case, let's say that those three devices are not Lisp aware, but the cell phone is. So this is the example where it's EID mobility, right? The phone is acting as the Lisp router. It's RLOAPs on the phone are the ones that are bounded to those three EIDs. Well, it turns out as I walk around, the cell phone's going to change from LTE to Wi-Fi. The Wi-Fi hotspots are going to change. Therefore, the RLOAPs of that phone are going to change, right? But it's going to fade share. The three EIDs, since they're on my body, they're always going to have the same RLOAPs, right? So rather than me advertising three EIDs with the pair of RLOAPs into the mapping system, I could make it a /30, right, and advertise it. And then that's only one entry in the mapping system. So not only does the mapping system scale because it doesn't inject routing information in the underlay, but we can also use aggregation and prefixes in the system to reduce the number of mapping entries that are in the system as well. Now, if I take off my shoes and give them to Melichor and he wants to walk around, then he actually took a more specific out of my /30. What has to happen? Well, he has to register that /32 through his RLOAPs on his phone, right? And that's a more specific that's put in the mapping system and not in the underlay, right? So these things have happened. And we've been able to do this where when you have this hybrid stuff going on in an on-prem data center and you want to move a rack or a set of functions out in VMs to Amazon, well, the set of functions always work together, a set of IP addresses. So that's a cluster that could be in the same power of two EID block, and they could move from the RLOAPs from on-prem to the RLOAPs at Amazon, and it could be just a one prefix that actually moves that shows you that maybe a dozen addresses are actually moving at the same time. So that explained, so that explained how we do mobility and where RLOAPs can be and how router vendors could do it to support aggregation. But it turns out with these blockchain nodes moving around and functions that we're starting to locate the Lisp functionality, yes, very much on the edges. In 2014, I did a demo with Arista, A10, Aruba and HP. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to move a Mac from Wi-Fi to Ethernet back and forth. And so when we moved it to Wi-Fi, it was using Aruba Lisp. We were moving it to Ethernet. We were using a ProCurve HP box running Lisp. And then in the data center, we were using an Arista top of rack switch on one part of the data center. And in another data center, we were using the A10 load balancer. And we were showing that a VM was moving from one data center to the other. So you see what's going on. The VM is moving from A10 to Arista back and forth, while the Mac was moving from Aruba to HP. So those were four independent vendors that were running Lisp data plane. They were using Lispers.net as the mapping system. And as the laptop was moving, changing its laptop, its RLOAP, and the VM was moving, changing its RLOAP, they were being registered in the mapping system. And we were keeping TCP connections up because the connections were being made from the laptop's EID to the VM's EID. And the RLOAPs changing underneath was just a level of indirection that was done at the IP layer. So that was an example how the EIDs were moving, but the infrastructure was running Lisp. And that was running it very much at the edge meaning one IP hop away from where the end hosts were. And the underlay was completely untouched. These systems were all over the place in their own enterprises. We were using the capital I internet to reach them. But
I was surprised by how fast it was, right? It was like just within a second or something, it could switch over.
Yeah, we used TTL since we weren't using event notifications there because the vendors haven't implemented all the features in Lisp. We used 1 second TTLs. So there you go.
Right. my counter in my head was about correct.
If you go back and look at the video of that and you look closely enough at the mapping system, you'll see that the map cache entries had 1 second TTLs on them. So that'll be cool to go back and look at that. But so we want to move things even closer to the edge. So maybe we move Lisp into a hypervisor, into a server where the applications are running. Or maybe we run the application in a container that's running on a VM, and Lisp also runs in the container. And this example voting app is I have a Docker image that you bring up, and Lisp comes up, and the voting app comes up together. So basically the voting app and the blockchain, so it was a full stack solution, the app, the blockchain, and Lisp all ran in the Docker image as one independent system. So they were running as different processes, so they were modular and that they could be fault tolerant and fault isolated and everything like that. But each one of those components could come up or down independently, and state is being preserved. Okay, so a lot of the things that I am doing now is trying to build a full stack and solve full stack problems. And so, yes, Lisp is coming in these Docker containers and running. So I could run this voting app on all three popular cloud providers and talk to each other, right, and make it work. What we're seeing is we also played with an idea where we had a routing container and an application container, and you can kind of guess what happened there. The application container would then use a default route, which was the routing container, right? But then we said, well, why take all those extra hops in memory? Just co-locate it so it would be very efficient. And so even though you can put Lisp in a hypervisor and the application in the host OS, in the guest OS, co-locating them was even more efficient. And so I'm using those more in more use cases now where they're actually the functionality of the network layer are being co-located. So yes, the EIDs and the RLOCs are moving at the same time as if Amazon decided to change my RLOC whenever they want. That voting app could keep running, right? Because I would detect the IP address change. I would register my EIDs to the mapping system. Anybody who was encapsulating to that EID now would encapsulate to the new RLOC that Amazon gave me, and packets are coming into me now.
This is awesome.
Cool.
Because Melchior actually just sent me a chat saying, why is everyone not using this? Why are not all the SD-WAN vendors using this? And why are not all the clouds using this to connect systems, or at least transfer systems from an existing data center over to a cloud data center or something? I know that there are use cases where this is used, but
I worked with a lot of SD-WAN vendors, and initially they wanted to build their own intellectual property. They didn't want to go to standards where everybody would be the same. So you know the way BGP works. Everybody implements BGP, but they do it differently and solve different use cases, and that differentiates them as vendors. So what I tell my advice to the SD-WAN vendors is build an interoperable control plane. Do whatever you want at the data plane. Offer your services and features just like you do with BGP. But maybe use the Lisp control plane so you guys can interoperate with each other. Then you're going to make your customers happy because they don't feel like they're getting locked in with one versus the other. And as we're seeing with the SD-WAN vendors, there's consolidation that's happening. So if you pick your favorite SD-WAN vendor because you like the executives, you like the engineers, you like the solution, and then they get gobbled up by a big company that you may not like, then you have to live with that. That's why you want interoperable solutions. We know that as router vendors, right? We wouldn't be able to build the internet without BGP and OSPF, right? Yeah. And RSVP, and it goes on and on and on, right?
Yeah, well, we've been talking about open standards all our life, and then suddenly SD-WAN comes around, and then everyone buys into the lock-in. So, it's
I'm wondering why this is happening. And I stand up and I go, "Don't you guys remember the early '90s and what happened?" And then I look around the room and I realize that most of the people in the room were really young in the early '90s. So they need the history lesson. So that's the problem. It's a generational change, and the same mistakes are being repeated over again. But that's okay. It'll take time to realize it. The market, will the market decide? We'll see. I'm not sure. But there'll be pain along the way, and you want to really avoid the pain, right? So,
sure. Dino, we're almost close to the hour. So one final question, a personal question to you. What is the future for you? I mean, I know you're going to be talking about Lisp for the rest of your life, but I've also seen you become active in the Quantum Internet Research Group, for example. So what is the areas of interest for you personally going forward? Is it quantum internet or?
I think you got it right. This overlay solution, this level of indirection is really helping in so many ways that I'm going to, yes, keep pushing it because I think it's helping, allowing to connect a lot of new use cases. I'm going to keep coding and experimenting with protocols, doing lots of applications. The quantum internet is exciting, but disappointing to us networking guys. We really wanted to go faster than the speed of light, and the physicists just told us we're crazy. We can't do that. Because could you imagine building an overlay network on top of something that go faster than the speed of light? Or just think about changing a particle close to you and it changed. Could you imagine me changing a particle here in San Jose and it entangled and therefore changed in Amsterdam? That would be way cool. So there's going to be a lot of ways of doing networking in the future, but we need quantum to computers to be able to talk to each other. And that's why the quantum internet effort that's in the IRTF is happening, because it's basically how to get quantum to computers to talk to each other over long distances, which means they'll need to use the classical internet as well. So is it a quantum internet where you're moving photons, a different optical layer? That's also subject for further research. Other things that are really cool is, what if we put an underlay off the surface of the Earth up in space and run routing on GPS coordinates? So the Starlink effort that's going on with SpaceX is extremely important. All the low Earth orbit stuff is incredibly cool. And will it democratize and decentralize the internet? That's another passion I have about looking at the future. I remember when I started the internet, everybody would run their own mail servers, right? And if I couldn't send mail to you, I would tell you on a telephone call and you would check your mail server. And of course, we had very much peer-to-peer networking. Unfortunately, we weren't encrypting packets at the point, but we were getting shortest path from my house to your house and nobody could snoop on our packets. You know, that was hairpin somewhere else. Now that we have all this host-based and cloud-based data, they're snooping on everything. And that's not the worst part. I mean, forget privacy. We've lost it. That train's left the station. But the fact that they're selling our data and they're not paying us for it, that's something that has to be fixed as well. So I have this passion for decentralization. And can we get back to the original internet host model where a host and host could talk to each other without having to hairpin through another host because you need this high-level service? I did a presentation last year at VMware that I definitely will share with you guys about what's going on with the internet and what needs to be fixed. That would be something good to discuss about. It's a little philosophical, but it brings in all the experience we've had with protocols and deployment and building boxes as vendors over the years. So I'll forward to that to you guys after the call.
I already hear a lot of topics for future discussions, right? The democratized, decentralized internet, which is, I'm not sure if are you familiar with the show Silicon Valley? They have about the same goal, right? So we first need to solve compression or something. The second is, I'd like to really learn more about your operating system work that you've done, because I think that's also very interesting, and I think that people overlook that work a lot in our business because we only seem to talk about protocols. And and indeed about the future of the internet, what needs to be fixed. I mean, that's one of the, in our world, the most philosophical question we can ask, I think. So Dino, one final question from my side.
I just want to say, in terms of OSs, we're finding that in OSs, we need to scale down to the Raspberry Pi and IoT devices. So microkernels and unikernels are interesting things. And then looking at very purpose-built operating system, like an operating system where blockchain and hard security are built into the operating system. So those are kind of two extremes. And these blockchain OSs are not going to only, you know, run on, you know, hardware-rich type environments, but also may have to run in smaller IoT gateways and those sorts of footprints. So that's a definitely interesting space as well.
Yeah, for sure. One final question from my side is, because I think if you're not familiar with Lisp, and we do these podcasts by assuming that people have basic knowledge about basically everything that we talk about, because it makes it easier to start talking right away. Is there a quick resource that you can refer to explain all the acronyms that we've talked about, the abbreviations, and all the other work that you've done in Lisp?
Yeah, the acronyms could be described in 6830. That's the most formal and authoritative definition of it, and agreed upon definition of the things. Other places you can go is I've been running a Facebook group called Lisp Routing for about 10 or 12 years now, I think. And it has a lot of history about what's going on in Lisp chronologically. That would be useful too. I have a lot of presentations and videos at my www.lispers.net. That's a place you can go as well. There's also a Lisp Routing group on LinkedIn as well. By the way, you can get to those groups from my webpage too. I have a lot of IETF presentations I've given, and I thought I don't have a lot of them posted on my website, but I'm planning on doing that because it's becoming pretty voluminous now. Not only the number of use cases that we're introducing, but how they evolved over different IETF working groups. The 5G stuff is really interesting as well. The big question is, should we put Lisp in a mobile phone or should we put it in an eNode B and put it in the network? And that's really interesting as well. So I've been doing work with the 3GPP and Huawei and Cisco and all the routing vendors on how to make Lisp work. And that predictive RLOC thing about near zero packet loss, we don't have time for it today, but that was a way of, if you know you're going in a certain direction, you might as well send packets there, and packets will be waiting for you when you arrive at that roadside unit on a train or wherever. Each train station will have packets waiting for you because it knows you're going southbound. So it's basically near zero packet loss. That's called predictive RLOCs. We're predicting where you're going to be, so we're sending packets to places where we think you're going to show up, and we'll be able to verify if you're there or not. So that's something we could talk about in the future, or you can look it up as well. Of course, there's a link on my website to the IETF documents, and there's a lot of RFCs. There's a lot, you know, a good bibliography of RFCs, old and new, current working group documents, internet drafts that we're working on, those sorts of things. There's a lot of material. Also, go to Cisco's website and just type in Lisp routing there. The reason I say use Lisp routing, because people confuse Lisp with either the programming language or the speech impediment. And so when you search for Lisp on like Twitter, you get all kinds of stuff. So
wow.
yeah.
This was great. I mean, we got a sort of 360 degree view on Lisp use cases. We discussed a brief history, some of the future. So this was really brilliant. And I think, okay, with that, Dino, I would say a big thanks. Thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
I'm very much looking forward to having another discussion. You proposed a few topics, and I think we should follow up on that. And with that, we've come to the end of the Routing Table podcast. If you're interested in any of our other episodes, check out our website, routingtable.cloud, or find us in your favorite podcast app.